Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. On Friday, Amazon warehouse workers on Staten Island made history by voting to join the Amazon Labor Union, an independent worker-led labor group. The vote was 2,654 to 2,131. Christian Smalls, the president of the Amazon Labor Union, just tweeted that the union has been contacted by workers in over 50 buildings nationwide, not including several buildings overseas. Here is Christian Smalls discussing this historic victory on Democracy Now.
We started 11 months ago, grassroots worker-led movement. You know, just Amazon workers, former, current, like myself, just trying to do the right thing. Once again, no resources, no major backing, just a bunch of ordinary people just coming together from all over the country. We had different people flying in to help us out. Some of the comrades that I traveled the country with, advocating with. And 11 months ago, we started something that we really didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. But we just knew that it was working for us. You know, we were consistently talking to our workers every single day. Me, unfortunately, not being able to go inside the building. It was just a combination of me and Derek on the inside-outside game. You know, me at the bus stop, connecting with workers, earning the trust, building relationships. Derek actually inside the building, talking to workers every day in his department, taking over his old department. You know, things like that help us get us to this point. And I'm just ecstatic and excited to, you know, be the interim president and lead us to this victory. It's wonderful to see. And I'm happy to just once again share this experience with the entire world.
Christian Smalls, the president of the Amazon Labor Union, discussing this victory on Democracy Now. Christian Smalls said he could not go into the building, and that is because he was fired by Amazon, which we will talk about on today's show. So how did a brand new union manage to do this? Christian Smalls said they spent $120,000. They went on GoFundMe to raise money. Amazon paid anti-union consultants roughly $4.3 million, according to reports. Joining us to talk about this victory and the wider fight to organize are two guests. Dave Jamieson is a labor reporter with the HuffPost, and he has been writing about union busting efforts by Amazon. Hi, Dave. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. John Logan is professor of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. Hi, John. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me on.
Great to have you. So first off, let's just talk about how historic this is. Just to remind everyone, Amazon is the country's second largest employer in the country behind Walmart. They have 1.1 million employees, more than 1,100 warehouses, and Jeff Bezos is the second wealthiest person on Earth. So, John, let's start off with you. Just talk about how historic this is.
Yeah, it's really kind of mind-blowing in a way. I mean, Amazon, I would say, is by far the hardest company on the planet, probably, at which to win a union election. I mean, you know, when it comes to its anti-union campaign, it's the wealthiest, it's the most sophisticated, it's the most determined. And, you know, we've seen that many, many times before. Amazon, time after time, has been able to crush every union campaign in the last, you know, 20 plus years. And, you know, the first time we had a big union election at Amazon was a year ago in Bessemer, Alabama. And, you know, that was a fantastic campaign by the RWDSU, but they were crushed in the first election. But Amazon cheated, according to the NLRB. There was a rerun election. But during that election, we get a sense of all of the different things that Amazon does during anti-union campaigns. And so, like you said, it's astounding that, you know, in a big unit like this, you know, unions never, ever win units of 8,000 employees, and they never, ever, ever win against Amazon. So it's just incredible.
And it is so important to highlight that this is a brand new union. I mean, we're not talking mm-hmm. about a well-established union that has a ton of money and a ton of contacts. You cannot get more grassroots than the Amazon Labor Union.
Yeah. I think that helped it in many ways. And, you know, if you read the media accounts, and, you know, Dave has written fantastic reporting, you know, the media coverage has just been outstanding. And if you read a lot of the stories, you really get a sense of, you know, the type of organizing tactics, you know, the way they raise money, the way they had some outside advice, the social media, the media use. But it was, to a large extent, as Chris Small said, and the bit you played, it was a worker-led self-organization. It was a really, really important part of the campaign that, you know, the workers themselves, under U.S. law, have access, of course, if they work there. Outside organizers do not. One part of it, I'll just say this very quickly because I know you want to move on, but there was a national agreement between Amazon and the NLRB in December. It didn't really look like much. You know, you look at it and you were kind of underwhelmed. And Amazon seemed to continue with its very aggressive anti-union behavior after that. But one of the things that that national agreement in December with the National Labor Relations Board did is it expanded access, and that allowed these worker organizers at Staten Island to remain at work after, you know, their shifts had finished. And I have to say, there is an absolutely fabulous account in Jacobin of the sort of nuts and bolts of the campaign itself. Just looking at the author, his name, the interviewer is Eric Blank, but it's an interview with Angelica Maldonado, and it just gives, you know, one could not hope for or even expect a so instructive an accounting of how, you know, the JFK 8 got self-organized. I mean, the interview could almost serve as a how-to manual, you know, for Amazon's budding organizer, worker organizers, wherever they are out there. So we do get a sense of like how this happens. But, you know, the really exciting thing, and, you know, Dave can talk, you know, he's written fabulous stories about Starbucks too. But, you know, a lot of these successful campaigns at the moment, as you said, are non-conventional campaigns. They're really worker-led, based on self-organization, workers speaking to each other and to reaching out, you know, to others, you know, across the neighboring stores, across the country, in the case of Starbucks. In the case of Amazon, they had a dedicated group of intrepid young organizers, many of whom were, you know, quite political, according to the accounts. You know, they've been involved with, you know, Bernie's presidential campaigns, with DSA, you know, with other leftist organizations. They were absolutely dedicated. But, you know, because they were part of the workforce, they spoke with a really powerful authenticity. And, you know, they knew what kinds of arguments would resonate with the workers, because, you know, they could say, you know, we know what it's like to work in this warehouse and to be treated with a lack of respect. We are just like you. And that's also partly why Amazon's anti-union tactics, the traditional tactics, the captive audience meetings, you know, they are the themes that, you know, the union is an external third party, which it used at Staten Island. And they just rang completely hollow because, you know, the workers knew that wasn't true, that they were the Amazon labor union. It wasn't an outside external third party. And, you know, you had workers challenging consultants. I mean, Dave, what a great, great story about how the workers were able to use Amazon's anti-union consultants against the company during the campaign. And so I'll let Dave tell the story. But, you know, it really was a fabulous story. I mean, many of these tactics and themes that have worked for decades in anti-union campaigns actually kind of turned out to be a liability during this campaign because of the unconventional nature of the organization and a lot of their tactics.
Dave, as John said, you have been writing extensively about what's happening at Amazon. You wrote about the union busters, the millions that have been spent on all of this. So overall, can you just tell us how historic this victory is?
Yeah, it's really remarkable for all the reasons that John explained. There's one, the fact that this was Amazon, that's so stunning. The size of this warehouse, as John said, unions in the U.S. do not win elections in the private sector at workplaces this large. For kind of the scale of what's been pulled off here, you have to go, you know, way back in U.S. labor history to find things that are analogous. But even setting aside Amazon, what is partly so remarkable about this is the union that pulled it off. As we said, Amazon Labor Union. This was formed literally just months ago, about 11 months ago. You know, Chris Smalls had been fired. He had worked in the JFK 8 warehouse. And, you know, he and his friend Derek Palmer started this effort that, frankly, to a lot of people seemed a little wacky, to like go off on their own without kind of institutional support and try to unionize this giant warehouse that many people believed is essentially unorganizable in modern times. And so, you know, and I'll be honest, unless, you know, to make sure I don't come off as a really smart guy here, mm-hmm. I was one of the people who really doubted what they were trying to do. I did not think that a group of folks, no matter how dedicated, could pull off something like this really without the resources of a traditional union. To kind of explain the difference here, an established union has a large paid staff. They have resources coming in the form of worker dues, and they pay professional organizers with that. And also, in the case of the union campaign in Alabama at Amazon, they also were able to pull in a lot of their members who work at poultry plants and other places like that to kind of come work on the campaign. And so they had this kind of, you know, larger staff of experienced people to run the campaign. Here, they had very little outside help. They had very little money. It was, you know, through GoFundMe, it ended up being around $120,000 that they had to work with. The lawyer who was advising them worked at a different union on staff, and he was helping them pro bono. So this was really a total grassroots effort that people everywhere who track this stuff, including myself, you know, we're really doubting where it could go. And so I was as stunned as anybody to watch the votes coming in. And granted, you know, Staten Island is not Alabama, right? It's a very high union density state. There's more union support there. But really the resounding yes that came out of this election was really quite remarkable.
And also, for people who are not familiar with this particular warehouse, so this is called the JFK 8, and it's got 8,000 workers. It's one of the most important pipelines to the market, right? I mean, this is a really important warehouse.
Yeah, well, frankly, all of Amazon's large fulfillment centers are important. They do have a lot of them now, but I think a lot of times a company, when something like this happens at a non-union employer, there are past analogs with Walmart and with Dollar General, when workers successfully unionize an outpost, all of a sudden things change, and you know, maybe that store disappears. And that happened with Dollar General, where a store that was unionized simply got shut down. It's one thing to close a store that has six workers at it, you know, in rural Tennessee. It's another thing to try to shut down a major logistics hub in New York City. So I think this union having a toehold in there, it's a very serious toehold. I mean, they have an extremely difficult road ahead. This is really, you wouldn't really understand this, but it's kind of the first step. It's sort of remarkable. What they've pulled off is really incredible, but it's kind of just the beginning of the fight in a certain way, because they need to secure a first contract. And that's can be notoriously difficult in this country. It can drag on for years. And I have no doubt that Amazon is going to delay this as best they can, and to really try to do everything in their power to not give these workers a good contract. And so this is kind of the start of the battle. And it also is just, you know, one facility out of hundreds. And so it becomes harder to really go toe to toe with the company when you're sort of just, you know, one facility in a sprawling network of them that is unionized. And I think that's why, you know, as Chris Small said earlier today, they've been hearing from dozens of other facilities. I do think it's probably important for this union that they continue to grow if they're really going to establish themselves within Amazon.
John, can you talk more about that? About how this is just the beginning. The Amazon labor right. union is demanding that Amazon start bargaining in early May and cease yep. any changes to employment terms. They're going to actually have a press conference about this on yep. Friday. So tell us more about how this process works.
Yeah. So, I mean, David's absolutely right. This is just the first step. And I'll talk about that just a second. But I would like to say, though, it's the first step. But, you know, the importance of these victories, this one more than ever, you know, but the Starbucks victories too, it's not about the numbers of new members. You know, it's not about 8,000 new union members or, you know, each time Starbucks Workers United has won 10 out of 11 elections, you know, and it gets like, you know, 25, 30 new members each time. If it were only about the numbers, it would be insignificant when you look at the depth of the crisis facing, you know, American unions and private sector now 6.1% into the private sector. You know, it would take decades to rebuild the labor movement if we were doing it on a workplace by workplace. You know, the importance of these campaigns, Amazon, Starbucks, is that, you know, they have the potential. They really capture people's imaginations. You know, those companies are subjected to the public gaze in ways that most companies are not. So they generate all of these fantastic media stories. They inspire workers. They create a sense of optimism and energy. And, you know, workers, as you said, with the Chris Smalls, being contacted by all of these other potential Chris Smalls out there, other Amazon warehouses. You know, this is why they're important, you know, more than the actual single victory. But yes, I mean, this is going to be an incredibly tough fight. And the thing we know about Amazon, I mean, Amazon Labor Union has proved that Amazon is not invincible. But we know that Amazon is relentless. It just never gives up. And, you know, so two things I think that we would expect. We would expect Amazon to double down on its anti-union efforts at other facilities, all of these other places where they think, you know, they look at the Amazon labor union and think, hey, if they can do that, we can do it too. And, you know, from you know, perspective of someone who supports unions and collective bargaining, that's why they're so important. From Amazon's perspective, you know, this is why they're going to double down on the campaign. They don't want to lose control of this the way that appears to be happening at Starbucks, you know, where over 170 stores have now filed for NLRB elections. They're much, much, much smaller. But still, you know, there's a sense that, you know, it's spiraling, you know, from Starbucks' perspective, that the whole thing is just sort of spiraling out of control. Amazon doesn't want that. It was bad that they lost in Staten Island, but they don't want to lose anywhere else. So they have already announced their intention to challenge the result at Staten Island. I mean, the grounds for doing so are unusual. You know, they were saying there was objectionable conduct during the election, both by the Amazon Labor Union and also, interestingly, by the National Labor Relations Board itself, and particularly by its general counsel, Jenna Brusso, who's just been a force of nature since she came into her job. Employers and unions are able to challenge, allowed to challenge after elections on the grounds of objectionable conduct, either committed either by the parties, either by the employer or the union, and also by third parties. We saw this actually with the UAW and Volkswagen a few years ago when the Republican governor of Tennessee had threatened to withdraw state subsidies, which Volkswagen jobs depended upon if the union came in. So, but the difference here, of course, you know, unlike Amazon, the Amazon labor union has no coercive power over the employees. So it's going to be really, really tough for, you know, Amazon, not just, it's not going to convince the Biden NLRB, but even to convince the federal courts that anything untoward went on here that actually would have affected the outcome of the election. But most likely, it's just a delaying tactic. As Dave said, companies try to delay. They engage in hard bargaining. They take the attitude that you haven't lost until you sign a contract. They want the workers to become discouraged. They want the pro-union workers to leave the workplace. They want other workers to look at it and think it's futile because Amazon never gives up. Even if you win, you don't really win. I don't think that they will succeed at that, but I mean, that's certainly what they're trying to do. And, there are statistics for, how long it takes to negotiate first contract. And there are specifically statistics for warehouse and logistics. Sorry, I was just looking for it. I sent it to an Associated Press reporter this morning, but she asked me for it. It's about 360 days. But what I will say at Amazon, again, Amazon is going to be subjected to a really exceptional degree of both political and public scrutiny. The NLRB, local politicians, national politicians are going to be watching Amazon every step in the way. And, through the great reporting that people like you and many others, and Dave and many others are doing, they're going to be, again, subjected to this public gaze in a way that has probably never happened before. I mean, the thing about Amazon and Starbucks is that people have a much more direct relationship with those companies than the American public ever did with, General Motors or Ford in the 1930s or 1940s. So what happens, this is the biggest union story in 100 years. It's probably more reported than, globally than any other story. It's insignificant, but, I'm talking on Radio New Zealand about it, tomorrow or the next day. So, there's just this incredible interest. So Amazon will do everything it can to stall, delay, frustrate, put obstacles in the path of the Amazon labor union signing a first contract. And under normal circumstances, if you just look at the pattern of what normally happens, as Dave quite rightly said, you would look at it and said, this is just a very small part of the battle. But this is not normal circumstances. Nothing involving Amazon's anti-union campaigns is really normal. And certainly the victory of the Amazon labor union is not normal, like Dave said, apart from the union themselves. I was on Bloomberg TV with Chris Smalls a few days before the election, and he said with absolute certainty, we're going to win. And I should have believed him, but I didn't. But so, this is not normal, it's not business as usual. So yes, Amazon will do everything in its power, and it won't make the same, it made very bad mistakes during the anti-union campaign at JFK. I mean, to take nothing away from the Amazon labor union, who ran a magnificent campaign, Amazon made really bad mistakes. But of course, Amazon prides itself in being a sort of really cutting edge, innovative company, full of smart people who learn from their mistakes. It made basic mistakes in the anti-union campaign at Staten Island, but we shouldn't expect that it will make the same mistakes in future organizing campaigns. And I would actually say on that point, I'll finish really quickly. I'm sorry, I didn't want to go on. The campaign was magnificent. There's not just one thing, but a dozen things that we should all be learning from the Amazon labor union. But replication of the ALU campaign probably isn't the best way forward. I mean, there's only one first time. There may, in fact, as you read out that tweet, Chris Smalls saying he's gotten contacted by dozens of people at stores all across the country, even internationally. So there could well be, and I'm sure there are, dozens of budding Chris Smalls and Amazon facilities across the country. But trying to replicate, the amazing campaign of the ALU isn't, I don't think, probably the best way to go, because any future Chris Smalls, is going to be operating in a different environment, and also an environment that has been altered by the achievement of the original Chris Smalls. They're not going to be facing the same challenges. But, so what we need are more innovative, more grassroots, more worker-led self-organizing campaigns, but not identical to the ALU campaign, and learn from the ALU. But, Amazon's going to get smarter, and I do think it will intensify and double down on its anti-union efforts, which also just and I'll finish on this point, shows why Amazon workers who want to choose a union need better protection from the Biden NLRB. Mm. You know, this labor board has done a lot, you know, to help protect workers who want to, you know, to get a fair choice as the law demands that they should have. But what we need is, you know, more of these 10J injunctions, court orders against Amazon firing and discriminating against pro-union workers. And we need corporate-wide remedies. You know, Amazon's anti-union campaign doesn't take place at Staten Island or at Bessemer. It's coordinated through corporate headquarters. It's centralized. You know, it's done, you know, with the law firms, with the consultants, with the internal union consultants. And that's also how the labor board must approach it, you know, in order to, you know, to make clear that this is what Amazon is doing, and so that it can send the message to pro-union workers. You know, the remedies are inadequate, but we're going to do it. Everything we can to protect your right to choose a union at Amazon, if that's what you want to do.
We're going to take a quick break, and after the break, we'll talk more about the NLRB. Just to also remind everyone, the worker demands were the demands that we're hearing from workers at Starbucks, at Amy's Kitchen, at REI. Workers wanted or want higher wages, longer break times, and safer working conditions. That's what Chris Smalls and Gerald Bryson have said that their demands were, very basic, and also Derek Palmer. Higher wages, longer break times, and safer working conditions. We'll also talk about that after a break. John Logan is professor of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. Dave Jamieson is a labor reporter at HuffPost, and we're talking about the historic vote by Amazon workers on Staten Island voting to join the Amazon Labor Union, an independent worker-led labor group. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss ongoing demand at food banks across the country. People are really struggling to make ends meet, and they are seeking assistance at food banks, but then they're struggling to keep up. Later in the show, we'll speak with Andy Fisher, author of Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. And then on Thursday's show, we will talk about the gun violence that we have sadly seen in the country, just a shooting in Sacramento, California, a couple of days ago. We will talk about whether or not there's been any movement on gun control. Today, we are talking about Amazon warehouse workers on Staten Island making history by voting to join the Amazon Labor Union, an independent worker-led labor group. If you have any questions, comments, thoughts about this, I mean, this is really historic given that the new union raised money on GoFundMe. They spent about $120,000. Amazon paid anti-union consultants about $4.3 million, according to reports. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you are involved in any union efforts, we'd love to hear from you. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also tweet at yourcallradio. Dave, just going back to just how historic this is, to think that Amazon really has endless money to spend on this. There was just a story that's getting a lot of attention because of this vote. CNN reports that Amazon CEO Andy Jassy, who became the CEO last summer, he got a pay package valued at $212 million, $212 million. Nearly all of this is going to come in the form of stock options that will vest over 10 years. But I mean, we're talking about big money, and you actually report that a 2020 analysis by the Economic Policy Institute found only a few employers have spent more than $1 million on anti-union consultants, and it typically takes several years to rack up such a bill. I mean, so we're talking about, you know, Amazon is spending a lot more than other companies, and they have money to really burn.
Yeah, their resources are essentially bottomless. But the $4.3 million, that is a lot of money to spend directly on anti-union consultants who go into the warehouse to try to convince people not to unionize. But the reality is that's just a fraction of the money that Amazon would have spent on these campaigns overall. And John is a world-renowned expert on this union avoidance work. The reality is Amazon, through their lawyers, through all of the literature in the warehouses, through all the messaging they're pumping through the televisions, and all of the stuff that they don't have to report to the federal government, the reality is they spent certainly several times that $4.3 million figure last year, or I should say almost certainly, since we will never really know. But what's incredible about this campaign is that the workers showed that even a small group, if they are very smart and very dedicated, can overcome a really deep-pocketed company campaign like this. I talked to one member of the organizing committee, Connor Spence, who is a worker at the JFK 8 warehouse, and it was very impressive how they took on these union busting consultants who came into the warehouse. These are people who come in, who hold group meetings, you know, talking about how the union's going to mess everything up and you're going to pay union dues and it's, you know, you're going to go on strike and this and that. And they're essentially trying to scare people out of voting for the union. They also go around the warehouse talking to people one-on-one, pulling them aside, trying to feel them out, figure out where they lean, and just kind of subtly turn them against the union, or not so subtly turn them against the union. In this case, the Amazon labor union filed, you know, dozens of charges against the company, accusing them of breaking the law through a lot of this campaign. And several of those charges involved consultants who were hired at, you know, an approximate rate is usually about $3,200 a day. That's kind of somewhat of an industry standard now. So they had these people in there, and an unknown number of them. And we're never going to have a real handle because the disclosure system is not great, and it's not enforced really well. But safe to say Amazon had a whole lot of these folks going through the warehouse for a very prolonged period. And the workers really threw these folks off their game in amazing ways. When they held meetings, the workers essentially took them over. They started challenging all of the talking points that they were getting from speakers that seemed anti-union. Some of the pro-union workers, Amazon had to pull them out of the meetings and just get them out of the room because they were shutting things down. And that was emboldening other workers. And when it came to the consultants, the workers were going around telling other workers after they had these discussions with the anti-union consultants, they'd show them, you know, paperwork saying, hey, that guy gets $3,200 a day to be here. Look at how much money he made last year busting up unions. And that really turned a lot of people against the consultants. And so this was like a very smart and very militant kind of inside campaign here, where I think the confidence of the worker organizers inside, as the campaign grew and they became more confident and they were willing to confront the company and its agents, I think that really made other people less afraid to go vote for the union when the time came for the election.
And a More Perfect Union actually had a video of this, and you could actually see the walls plastered inside the warehouse with anti-union posters. Workers were also required to attend anti-union meetings. So this was really nonstop when people went to work.
It was. And just for context, this is in a certain way, like completely normal. This is what employers do when they're faced with a viable union campaign. They usually go out and get consultants. Starbucks hasn't done that. Starbucks has, so far as we can tell, has kind of just schooled up their managers on how to do it. But their managers have been holding these meetings in stores all over the place. They flooded the Buffalo region when the union started making progress there. They flooded it with managers trying to dissuade people to unionize. It is a full, you know, real pressure campaign that companies, they tend to go into that mode when they're facing this. That said, what on Amazon, just because of the size of Amazon, I think in terms of its scale, this anti-union campaign probably doesn't have a whole lot of precedence in modern times, just because Amazon is Amazon. Their warehouses have several thousand people working in them. And so they really had to bring in lots and lots of people to try to, you know, pound this into all the workers' heads that don't sign a union card. And if you do, you know, vote no when we're having an election. And so workers in these warehouses, you know, a figure I heard was that you probably went into a meeting at least every week. I did speak to workers who thought they went into them multiple times a week down in Alabama. What funny thing one worker said to me was that he kind of lost grasp of it. And it was like all kind of, you know, jumbled in his head, because that was sort of the nature of this. And it's basically a propaganda campaign where you're just being sort of inundated with the company's information.
Can you tell us about some of these anti-union groups? There have been reports out there about how Amazon hired a Democratic Party-aligned pollster who works with these anti-union groups.
Yeah, so Amazon reporting from CNBC that they had hired a Democratic strategy and polling firm to kind of get its message together on how to defeat the union campaign. That doesn't reflect very well on the Democrats who run in those circles. And it, just as an aside, I will say an interesting political dynamic here is the Democratic ties to Amazon. Mm-hmm. Jay Carney, a former White House spokesperson under Obama, famously went to Amazon and has been a public face of Amazon. And so it is a company that now is kind of I guess under a lot more political pressure than it was a few years ago. But there is a political dynamic here where these very powerful corporations, have very cozy ties with a lot of the people, in this country who are running the show. Howard Schultz at Starbucks was, infamously floated as a possible labor secretary in a Hillary Clinton presidency, if that ever came to pass. And we don't know whether that would have ever been, but it certainly sounds plausible. And all of these companies, at the end of the day, they usually turn out to be fiercely anti-union when the rubber hits the road.
Does former Obama administration and Jay Carney, does he still work at Amazon?
As far as I know, he does. Yes.
Huh. And it looks like I'm looking him up right now. It looks like he hasn't said anything about this.
Imagine that.
Right. Let's talk more about that just quickly, John, just the connection between especially Democrats and some of these companies like Amazon and Starbucks.
Yeah. Well, Steve Greenhouse, a former New York Times reporter, now writes a lot for The Guardian and other publications, wrote a terrific piece just recently, which was basically talking about this sort of trend of progressive anti-unionism. You know, companies like Starbucks, REI, and to an extent Amazon too, that really tout their progressive credentials. I mean, we're not talking about the oil and gas industry here. We're not talking about, industries that have always been aligned with Republican Party. Overwhelmingly, in fact, these companies, the heads of the companies probably give money to Democratic. I mean, they may give money to all sorts of politicians, but, they're identified with a lot of progressive causes, progressive politicians. But when it comes to unions, no way. They take the view, as Howard Schultz does, as I'm sure Jeff Bezos does, and, head of REI notoriously started a captive audience anti-union meeting at the store in New York that unionized with a land acknowledgement and talked about his pronouns and then, launched into an anti-union diatribe. But their view is that, unions are fine for auto plants or for coal mines, but not here, not at Starbucks, not at Amazon. And in fact, I would say that Amazon is probably even more deeply anti-union than sort of traditional U.S. corporations, because, this idea of being committed to unilateral control of the workplace is just, it's kind of imprinted on its DNA. It thinks that unions are completely antithetical to everything the company and the business model are based on. Very rapid innovation, the ability to move quickly, to change direction, all of this stuff. Collective bargaining, sharing decision-making, rigid union rules as it sees them, they just don't work in the context of a company like Amazon. The captive meetings, if I just go back to that really, really quickly, I promise it will be quick. Super interesting thing is that, workers can be fired for refusing to attend captive meetings. But when they disagree with consultants at the actual meeting. They're engaging in protected activity. And, you know, when they challenge the consultants, because the consultants are basically just giving a barrage of disinformation, you know, either out and out truths or statements are designed to confuse and intimidate. And, you know, when they're challenged, their authority very quickly crumbles. And, you know, another great thing about the Amazon campaign and Starbucks too, I would say, is, yeah, you know, sparking all of the other organizing is absolutely essential, but they also make people pay attention and understand the issues. One of the biggest obstacles to labor law reform in the United States has always been that, you know, people have no idea how the law works. No one understands it. No one cares about it. And the labor movement's always had lacked a language with which to explain to people why they should care and why it's important. But Amazon and Starbucks have really started to change that, and people are paying attention. And so when they hear about, you know, these multi-billion dollar corporations forcing $15 an hour employees on the threat of dismissal to attend these anti-union propaganda sessions that are conducted by consultants who are paid several thousand dollars a day. You know, these things, that's not right. That shouldn't happen. That shouldn't be allowed. And the Biden NLRB, by the way, is taking on this issue, or has indicated the willingness to take on the issue. And a lot of the unfair labor practice charges at Staten Island and at Bessemer with the RWDSU campaign at Amazon do actually challenge the right to force people to attend captive meetings, which has been allowed for decades, but it doesn't require a change in the law. The PRO Act would prohibit mandatory meetings, but the Biden administration can actually do something. It can say to Amazon, you have the right to talk, you know, to say that you're opposed to unions, but you don't have the right to force workers to listen. So they can separate those issues and say, yeah, you know, issue all the anti-union propaganda that you want, but you cannot force people to attend these meetings. You cannot force them to listen to your propaganda. And, you know, it's an open question as to whether or not that would stand up to the inevitable legal challenge. But the Biden administration, Biden NLRB, I think, is not afraid to take these issues on. But more importantly, it's the campaigns like Amazon and like Starbucks that have allowed the Biden administration to take these issues on and have allowed us at least the possibility of having a national debate about the pitiful state of labor rights in this country. And I really think without that debate, we'll never, ever get labor law reform, because, you know, you can't just push it through the Senate when no one is looking. The anti-union lobby will always be too powerful. It will always be more powerful than the labor lobby. So unless people are engaged with the issues, feel that they have a stake in the outcome. And again, I would say that, you know, Amazon and Starbucks, you know, people are paying attention more than they have in, you know, well over half a century at least. And so, you know, this is why it's an optimistic moment. It could all amount to nothing still. Yeah, it could all just sort of evaporate into smoke. But I don't think it will, because I think that, you know, Amazon Staten Island has showed that the consciousness of the workers has changed, particularly young workers. You know, after having worked through a pandemic for 2 years and feel that they have not been treated with respect and they have not been adequately rewarded. This was the thing with the Staten Island campaign. Amazon labor unions, since they were workers, you know, in a couple of fired workers, former workers, workers in the warehouse, they understood. They understood what it was like to be treated without respect in there. Amazon and its consultants didn't appear to believe it, understand
and John,
that had changed.
John, yeah, we're almost out of time, and I just want to make sure we have enough time to talk about what's going on at places like Starbucks and Amy's Kitchen. But before we do that, I think it's important that we talk about the racism that was involved here and the racial elements of this. I mean, Krish Smalls and Derek Palmer are both Black men, and the New York Times reports that Black associates at JFK 8 at this particular warehouse were almost 50% more likely to be fired than their white peers, according to an internal document. We don't have time to completely go over Krish Smalls' history, but I think another reason why he's getting so much attention is because of his history. The New York Times reports that he really wanted to go up in the company at Amazon. And yet during COVID, when they didn't have proper protective gear and people were getting sick, he helped organize some of his fellow workers to walk out over COVID-related safety concerns. And he was on their radar. And this has gotten a lot of attention. I'll just read from the New York Times because this is pretty incredible. And I know that you've reported on this, Dave. After Christian Smalls mobilized, Amazon formed a reaction team involving 10 departments, including its global intelligence program, a security group staffed by military veterans. The company named an incident commander and relied on a protest response playbook. Amazon's chief counsel described Christian Smalls as, quote, not smart or articulate in an email mistakenly sent to more than 1,000 people. And then also in May, an anti-union consultant called the mostly black labor organizers thugs. This is according to a complaint filed against Amazon. So there's a major racial element here to talk about, Dave.
There is a racial element, and another element is just, frankly, that people all over the place through these high profile cases are starting to see that people who speak up at work have a way of getting fired, right? That was the case with Chris Smalls. We're seeing it at Starbucks as well, where some union organizers have been fired, several down in Memphis. In some cases, it's going to be litigated to find out, which firings were legal. But firings like this are often done pretextually. Chris Smalls started making noise. I spoke with Chris a long time ago about his history in the company. He'd worked for Amazon for several years. He had worked at other facilities other than JFK 8, and he thought he was going to have a career there. And he was actually in kind of a pseudo supervisory role, when he was fired. But he spoke up. He had safety concerns about what was going on during the pandemic, and he had the gall to speak out with other workers about it and do something public. That's what preceded his firing. And the same case at Starbucks, where the people who have spoken up, they have ended up fired. And, it'll be litigated to determine whether there were legitimate reasons behind that. But we see over and over again that people who make bold stances and want to form a union and are very public about it, they often end up retaliated against.
Right. Well, and also, just to end, what are your thoughts about what's going on with other union efforts? REI workers in New York and Manhattan voted to unionize early last month. We've been talking about the Starbucks efforts to unionize. And I also just wanted to bring up workers at Amy's Kitchen. This is the vegetarian frozen food company. They also have now restaurants. According to NBC, workers filed official complaints saying they do not have access to clean drinking water during their shifts. They're at risk of developing repetitive motion injuries. And we did hear from the Teamsters this morning. The workers have not called for a boycott, but community groups and allies are calling for a boycott. According to the Teamsters, the workers are calling on Andy Berliner and Amy's ownership to come up with a meaningful, permanent solution to address safety and health issues that they've been experiencing. And John, once again, stop hiring, quote, labor consultants, stop with the scare tactics, and allow the unionization process to play out without employer interference.
Yeah. I think all of those campaigns are incredibly hopeful and inspirational. As you say, they're all facing really brutal anti-union campaigns, and the workers need stronger protections. But so many of those campaigns that you mentioned, Starbucks, REI, I'm vegan, so I know Amy Kitchens, but I don't know that much about the campaign. I should know more. But a lot of them are similar in certain respects. Worker-led self-organization, even if there's a traditional union involved in the background, That's not why the organizing is taking off. That's not why it's spreading. That's not who's taking the lead. It's mostly these young workers, and as you said at JFK too, you know, people of color. Most of the workforce were Black and Latino. But again, I think they were able to use, and you know, Amazon's very, you know, clearly racist comments, and you know, the consultants' racist comments against Chris Moss, against others, against Amazon, because you know, people don't like a bully, and they don't like the feeling that their rights are being violated. In some ways, nothing energizes them more. And you know, this really just you know, the union was able to use it very effectively to portray Amazon as the bully that it is, you know, and say, you know, their vision of work is the sort of algorithmic management, completely disposable workers, low wages, and no independent voice at work. You know, if you come with us, we'll promise you, we'll make sure that's not how it is, and you'll get treated with respect. And, you know, I just think all of the campaigns are, you know, phenomenally inspirational. And, you know, despite the fact that nationally union membership is declining, you know, there's this disconnect because we're at this incredibly optimistic, hopeful moment with these campaigns and with the amazing media coverage and interest that they're generating. And the nature of the campaigns, you know, the fact that it's these young workers taking the lead and, you know, not professional union organizers for the most part.
And final thoughts from you, Dave, where do you see this going? I mean, there's just so much activity, as John says. In some ways, it's hard to keep up.
When the Starbucks campaign started to take off, I think a lot of us thought, you know, maybe there is something really happening here. After years and years of union membership declining and organized labor being on the ropes, you know, maybe this portended some sort of rebound. I think with the Amazon win, you know, it's undeniable that something's in the air. I think the tight labor market has a lot to do with it. There's kind of, at least for now, some leverage returning to the worker side. And I think it's really up to unions to do something with this. I mean, an independent union just pulled off something really incredible. I think, you know, established unions would be very smart to take whatever they can from that and build on it. I think unions would be smart to really be investing in sort of, you know, worker inside the workplace organizing right now. Unions can be, you know, really cautious creatures, and they can be understandably careful about where they put their often limited resources. But right now there's just something going on now. And I think unions really, if they want to survive, let alone grow, they really need to make the most of this moment.
Dave Jamieson is a labor reporter at HuffPost. John Logan is professor of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we didn't have time to talk about Warrior Met coal miners, but we'll just give you an update on that. More Perfect Union reports that they have been on strike for over a year as of April 1st. The company is trying to starve out the workers and weaponize cops and courts to shut down the picket lines, but they are going to hold out. Hayden Wright says, when you've been exploited for 5 years, you'll fight for as long as it takes to get your dignity back in the workplace. And you can find more information about that at More Perfect Union. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.